Welcome to Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot. Today I interview Bible scholar James McGrath.
I certainly, at the very least, have problems with accepting the absurd in one's own tradition, but rejecting it as absurd in somebody else's.
Remember to visit commonsenseatheism.com for more episodes and articles about God, science, and morality. Dr. James McGrath is an associate professor of religion at Butler University and the author of several books, including The Only True God, Early Christian Monotheism in Its Jewish Context. He also writes a popular blog at exploringourmatrix.blogspot.com. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Luke.
James, let me start with this. You are supportive of the Clergy Letter Project. What is the Clergy Letter Project?
The Clergy Letter Project is actually something that got started by an individual who ended up, in fact, becoming a colleague at Butler. Michael Zimmerman started this back when he was in Wisconsin, I believe. The issue of the teaching of evolution in public schools came up, as it so often does. And in his efforts as a biologist to support the teaching of good science in science classrooms, the idea came to him to get some statements of support for the teaching of evolution from clergy. He had already become aware of the fact that there were plenty of clergy who did not think that one should oppose the teaching of evolution, and in fact were supportive of the teaching of evolution as our best scientific understanding available. And he started this on the local level, and it simply grew and, if you'll forgive the terminology, evolved into something that essentially became a national and then international collection, essentially, of names and statements of support from clergy for the teaching of evolution. So that, in a nutshell, is the Clergy Letter Project. I'm not a member of the clergy, and so I'm not able to sign it myself, but I'm certainly supportive of the endeavor. And I've often thought it would be useful, and perhaps at some point I'll find the time to start a sort of biblical scholars letter project, because I think there are plenty of people in the academy when it comes to biblical studies who would likewise say that, from their perspective, the opposition to the teaching of evolution that you sometimes get from Christians usually reflects not only a poor understanding of the science, but also a poor or misunderstanding of biblical studies and what it has to say about the Genesis creation stories and topics like that.
Well, I think that's a good idea to have a Bible Scholars Letter Project.
We had, sometime since Michael Zimmerman and myself were at Butler, had somebody from, I think he's with Answers in Genesis, I might be mistaken, come to Butler to speak. And basically, you know, I raised some questions about why they're advocating a so-called literal approach to some of the details in Genesis, but don't take the doom that's mentioned in Genesis 1 literally. And this individual started to object that the term that's used in Hebrew doesn't mean doom. And of course, people in the audience, not knowing whether we both knew relevant languages or, you know, who to trust on this sort of issue, probably would have gone with whoever was saying what they wanted to hear, as we often as human beings are inclined to do.
Yeah.
But what happened, and it was very interesting, and I'm still not entirely sure how this happened or why exactly, but a colleague of mine who I think he's Eastern Orthodox, he certainly has shown himself to be somewhat hot-tempered in faculty meetings, but for some reason, in his hot-temperedness, he decided to quote one of the Beatitudes at this guest speaker in the original Greek. And I'm not sure why exactly he did it, but the individual who had been claiming some expertise on the meaning of the text in Genesis and the word that basically all Hebrew scholars say means doom, responded to this individual by saying, "I'm sorry, I don't understand biblical Hebrew when it's spoken." And so, misidentified the language. I came home and told the story, including the Greek quotation, Makarioi hai tokoi toptumati hoti auton te bisalea asalea ton uranon. I included even the statement, "I didn't tell my wife what the language was." She did, I think, a semester of Greek and no Hebrew when she was a student. And when I got to the point where the guy said, "Sorry, I don't understand biblical Hebrew when it's spoken," she said, "Wasn't that Greek?" So it doesn't take a lot of study of the language to at least recognize what the language is.
No, even when you said that phrase, I would have been able to tell that that was Greek and not Hebrew. They sound very different.
They certainly do. But I was glad this happened, even though, you know, it may not have been done in the nicest possible way. I know my colleague was a bit irritated with this individual. But I was somewhat delighted that we had, as it were, a public illustration of the fact that this person didn't know enough of the relevant languages to really have any kind of expertise to be making the claims that he was.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people are trusting these individuals because they use the language of defending the Bible and that sort of thing. And the truth of the matter is that they don't have the kind of expertise that you'd need to understand the Bible, much less know whether you're doing what's necessary to defend it, if you think it needs defending.
Well, you accused Ken Ham's creationist organization, Answers in Genesis, of preaching a false gospel. What did you mean by that, and what do you think of Ken Ham's response to you?
Well, I don't think Ken Ham responded if a response involves actually, you know, answering objections that someone has raised. I didn't see any of that in his pose. What he's tried to do is to stick that, you know, that nasty label of liberal on me, which, you know, I have no objection to be honest, but as though that somehow settles the question of, you know, whether my points have any legitimacy, whether my criticisms are accurate. It would have been nice if he'd at least showed some interest in addressing the question of. I certainly wasn't suggesting that groups like Answers in Genesis don't advocate some things that are there in the Bible and have a historic connection with Christianity. But there's certainly a lot that Answers in Genesis, like many contemporary organizations, particularly in America, but other parts of the English-speaking world as well. The truth is that American Christianity, there's a very strong identification with, you know, let's say, certain political parties, certain views on economics, which really seem to lead to there being a really serious blind spot. You look at the treatment of the Genesis stories, and there's certainly some of that in the Bible, and there's room for discussion and debates about interpretation. But there's a whole lot more mention of issues of justice, concern for the poor, defense of widows and orphans and the marginalized and things like that. And I really do get the impression that, particularly in my own context in the United States, it's something that many Christians desire. They want to be going against the flow. They have the feeling that that's the calling of a Christian. And things like young earth creationism give you a chance to feel like you're being a faithful minority. You're standing up against, you know, a majority that's going in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is that there are Christians who are doing it in those areas where, I mean, I would argue it's unnecessary and unhelpful, and are not being at all distinctive from the surrounding culture when it comes to, you know, concern for the poor and the marginalized, breaking down racial and social divides and things like that, which there's a long history of. Certainly there's a longer history of those things in connection with Christianity than there is of young earth creationism.
Yeah, and when I get into discussions like this, I often will quote Paul and say, you know, and these three remain, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is, what, faith? No, love.
Yeah, and even when talking about that, you know, faith, certainly one of the English usages, and certainly was within the range of the word in Greek as well, you know, is taking a leap of faith, believing perhaps without evidence or in spite of the evidence. But one of the primary connotations of the Greek word that's used, pistis, is faithfulness. And so even there, it's not clear that, you know, the greatest of these, even if he'd said faith, it wouldn't be clear that what that means is believing things either without evidence or in spite of the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
One of the passages I like to quote in context where this sort of thing comes up is that there's a statement in the letter to the Hebrews where it says, you know, faith is the evidence of things hoped for, you know, evidence of things unseen. It's not saying that, you know, it's evidence that the things that are seen don't exist, right? It's not saying that, you know, faith allows you to take the evidence that's been mounted up for something like evolution or something like that and say, well, I have faith, so therefore I can ignore all the evidence. It's one thing to say that it allows you to feel confident about things that you haven't seen. It's quite something else to say it allows you to feel confident in denying what you have seen.
Well, given that we have such overwhelming evidence for evolution and especially common descent, how do you think that the truth of evolution affects Christian doctrine? For example, if there was no literal Adam and Eve, then it seems like there couldn't have been a fall as depicted in Genesis, and the whole point of Jesus coming to die was to save mankind from the fall and sin and all of that. So what does Christian doctrine look like if evolution is true?
Well, that's a great question. It's obviously also a very big question, and I'm going to work under the assumption, unless you tell me otherwise, that you don't want me to try to articulate a comprehensive systematic theology that takes evolution into account.
You have 30 seconds.
Okay. I'll see what I can do. But certainly, maybe I should just plug some books, or at least mention the fact that there are plenty of theologians and authors who have tried to sort of articulate a Christian view of human existence, of doctrine and theology, that does precisely what you've asked. It's absolutely the case that if one takes the evidence for evolution, for common descent, seriously, then Christian theology is going to look very different than it tends to look in fundamentalist Christianity in our time. And what a lot of people who haven't studied the history of Judaism and or Christianity don't realize is that this contemporary group that we tend to refer to, for the sake of convenience, as fundamentalist Christianity, doesn't look a lot like the Christianity from any period in history before the modern one. Right? Fundamentalism, in all its forms, is essentially a response to and a reaction to science and other modern advances. And so even when it's rejecting science, it's doing so in a way that claims an alternative source of certainty and tries to essentially, it speaks the language of science and certainty and, post-Enlightenment era in a way that, pre-modern authors don't, whether they're Christian or atheist or Jewish or other things. And if we look back into the history of the way Genesis is treated and explored, I mean, we find both in Judaism and in Christianity a lot of, very interesting, very creative things done with the text, a lot of interesting and sometimes even playful explorations of the text, much more strongly represented perhaps in the Jewish tradition, right, where you have stories about Lilith, Adam's first wife, who was not submissive, and so God tries again and makes Eve, and all these kinds of things, which they make us chuckle, and they're supposed to, right? These are not treating the text with, such a, as it were, a reverent awe that you can't do humorous things with it. And so clearly, pre-modern interpreters had a very different approach to interpretation than modern ones. And I certainly have no problem talking about Genesis as myth, particularly if we use that in the technical sense of, a story of origins that seeks to explain what we see in the world, sort of in an etiological kind of fashion. And I think one of the things that myths are particularly useful for is exploring those aspects of life that we really can't talk about in other ways. For instance, you have this story about Adam and Eve in the garden, and they're naked and they're not ashamed. Every semester when I get to these stories, I ask students, who's naked and not ashamed? I'm always afraid they're going to say my roommate, which is not the answer I'm looking for. But, the answer that usually comes up is children, right? And this is really a depiction of, children and, this natural process that human beings go through as we come of age and at some point become capable of and then responsible for making moral decisions. In fact, one of the things that often misleads interpreters is that they'll read the story and oftentimes it will say, make reference to Adam, right, which of course is a modern English name. But in Hebrew, Adam is not a name. It's the word human being. And if we translated it into English that the main character, his name was human, let's say with a capital H, we might get a very different impression about whether this is a story about one person or two people long ago, or whether it's about human beings and human way of existence in general.
Right.
Certainly one thing I think is very ironic is that at the end of that story in Genesis 3, you have all this blame shifting, right? Well, it was the woman. Oh, it was the snake, kind of thing. And the irony is that a lot of modern interpreters take this story as a way of blame shifting. You know, why is humanity in the mess that we're in? It's not my fault, it's Adam and Eve. You know, there's something very ironic about that. But this story really, I think, does explore something that's an aspect of all human existence. And another question I ask my students when we look at these texts is, you know, when did you know that you were naked? I've yet to find students who really have, you know, or anyone that I've asked this to who really has a very clear single moment when they went from that youthful innocence when you run around naked and you're unabashed, as the Genesis story puts it, to being conscious of nakedness and becoming aware of, you know, all the aspects of young adult and then adolescence and then adulthood. It seems to me that it's a story about human existence. And although I'm pretty sure that Paul in the New Testament probably did assume that this was a story about a literal historical individual, it's not clear that one can't make sense of some of the things that Paul says in the New Testament about Adam, for instance, in comparing and contrasting Adam and Jesus. Clearly, when he says that, you know, in Adam all die, in Christ all are made alive, right? Through one man sin entered the world, you know, through another salvation. It seems to me that, you know, certainly his point about Jesus is not about being biologically descended from Jesus. It's about a different approach to life, it's about a different mode of existence, or a different type of existence characterized by different attitudes and outlook. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to me that one can't interpret it in that way, as contrasting two different approaches to life, rather than two different kinds of biological descent, because clearly I don't think any Christians think that his contrast is between people descended from Adam and people descended from Jesus. In fact, most Christians don't like that latter idea, in my experience.
So theologically, I'd be curious to know how you deal with this. Is the idea that, you know, whether or not there was a literal moment of the fall, humans are clearly fallen or inferior to God's plan anyway, and so that's what Jesus' mission was to save us from that?
Well, I think there's something behind your question that I'll also want to get to. But in terms of the whole notion of the fall, right, it's not a necessary way of thinking about the story in Genesis. Certainly in the Jewish tradition, that language is not used. And if one takes the story as being about human existence in general, rather than about one decisive moment at some point in the past, mm-hmm. then there's a sense in which we may want to still use the language of fallenness, but certainly when we bring evolution into the picture, it's clear that we didn't have ideal past when, you know, everything was roses and
right.
And then we messed up and now things are really, really tough. But on the other hand, there was someone, I keep forgetting who it was, who said that the doctrine of original sin is the one Christian doctrine that can be empirically verified. And it's a cute little quote, but in the sense that most people have this sense that, you know, human existence involves things not always going as we'd like, and even that our own decision-making process, right, we make choices, I think all of us make choices at some point in our lives, that we regret, right, that we're not entirely happy with. And it seems that certainly it is simply a matter of empirical observation that we seem to be a species that is capable of reflecting on our choices in a way that other organisms don't seem to evolve the capacity, or at least not to the same extent. They certainly seem not to do interviews and podcasts, you know, in which they talk about their decisions and reflect on them the way that human beings do. And so there's a sense in which, you know, this is a story that is exploring that aspect of human existence. And certainly there are going to be other ways that we'll want to think about this in light of our current scientific knowledge. But it's not clear that one has to necessarily discard the entirety of the Christian tradition simply because we have additional scientific information. One thing that we find even in the biblical texts is, as we move, say, from some of the earliest ones in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament into the New Testament, clearly there's a shift, right? You've got the influence of, you know, Greek natural philosophy, the Ptolemaic worldview, in which rather than there being a sort of three-tiered universe, you have multiple heavens, you know, surrounding a spherical earth. And throughout the history of Judaism and Christianity, we see progress in thinking as people adapt to new information. And so from my perspective, it's not at all clear that that process needs to stop, or that, you know, some particular kind of new information necessarily means that one absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt, must discard the entirety of the Jewish or Christian tradition and start from scratch, let's say. But I think behind your question was the view, you know, a particular view of the death of Jesus as a salvific event, as atonement, as a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that, historically speaking, seems very likely is that this understanding of the death of Jesus, this interpretation of the death of Jesus, was itself an attempt by the earliest Christians to make sense of something that happened that was very surprising and very hard for them to make sense of.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of expectations about what a Messiah, an anointed one, would do, being executed by the foreign rulers over the Jewish people was not one of them, right? It was not part of the expected role.
That wasn't part of the plan.
No, and so the question becomes, right, these early Christians clearly had experiences that persuaded them that even though this happened, they remained persuaded that Jesus was, in fact, the one that God had sent, the Messiah. And so then the question becomes, then how do we make sense of what happened, right? And in the context of their worldview, I don't think they could have put the question in another way than, why would God have foreordained that the Messiah die? And they drew heavily on concepts that were there in the Jewish tradition, like the idea of a martyr dying for the people. We have in some of the books of the Maccabees, even language of atonement being used in that context, in roughly the same time period, close to New Testament time. And so there's a drawing on the resources of their tradition in order to make sense of something that was genuinely perplexing. But certainly, just as we've talked about the possibility of rethinking sort of our understanding of anthropology and of human existence in light of scientific input, certainly both those scientific considerations and our perspective on history may require some rethinking about other aspects of Christian tradition, other metaphors, other symbols, other doctrines as well.
Let's move on to your approach to studying the Bible and the historical Jesus and early Christianity. You've written about the golden rule approach to historical research. What is the golden rule approach, and why do you advocate it?
Well, I advocate the golden rule because Jesus did. I'm a Christian. That's the short answer. But really, the golden rule, right, which is do unto others what you'd have them do unto you, is something that it struck me, even I think as an undergraduate, although I'm sure I didn't fully implement it, I realized that simply a question of fairness to treat the claims of others the way I would want my own claims and my own beliefs to be treated. And of course, conversely, to the extent that you're highly critical and sometimes skeptical of the claims of others, it seems that not inappropriate to turn that skepticism and that critical inquiry upon one's own assumptions and beliefs. And so really, it's just a question of fairness. And I've seen a lot of instances, I'm sure we all have, of individuals who have shown a willingness to believe things that they found in text, things that if they found them in any other tradition's text or in any other place other than in their own belief system, they probably would not accept the claim. And so it's simply an encouragement for us to try to be fair, right? To recognize where we have this penchant to accept the claims of those that we want to agree with and who we might be inclined to think of as on our side, and yet we're being more skeptical or unwilling to accept comparable claims from others. And so really it's just a statement of fairness, but I've rarely heard the golden rule applied to, you know, sort of historical study and as a sort of antidote to some of the kind of apologetics that really does make any kind of argument it can to defend what the apologist already believes, but would not accept the same kind of argumentation from somebody arguing for a different viewpoint.
Well, this is basically the identical idea that's behind the title of my website, Common Sense Atheism, because what I'm trying to say there is that if you apply the same kind of reasoning to your own religion as you do to other religions, then you'll find out that your own religion is false. And so that's just the same thing I'm saying, is if we're fair about our criteria, I think it tends toward atheism. And now I'm thinking I missed an opportunity because I could have called my website Golden Rule Atheism.
Well, that would be a very interesting combination. I'm sure it would be a very interesting discussion starter. You know, one of the things that is certainly problematic about the notion of common sense is that common sense, you know, once you start interacting with people from, you know, other cultures and with different assumptions, is that it often turns out to be not as common as we thought it was. And so, yeah, maybe golden rule atheism. That would be interesting.
I think that probably would be better. There's another problem with common sense atheism in that I don't actually value common sense very much. Common sense is very often wrong, which is why we need things like scholarship.
I would certainly agree, and particularly as science makes advances, it, you know, it's getting down and examining the subatomic particles and the makeup of things in a way that common sense doesn't give us access to those things. And certainly, particularly with the state of physics at the moment, it may be that where physics will end up may be someplace rather different, but where it is at the moment certainly runs counter to a lot of our common sense. I think that's safe to say. One thing that opened me to an appreciation of other religious traditions is precisely the fact that I saw within them, I had the opportunity to read things by, let's say, mystics and other traditions, and it sounded like very much, you know, what they were describing as their own experience was comparable to my own experience and within the Christian tradition. And certainly, at the very least, it seems to me that a golden rule approach leads to a possibility of a sort of a fair dialogue in which there's the possibility of learning from those we disagree with. If we're going to engage in conversation, then we need to listen to the arguments of people who are starting from a different tradition or a different set of assumptions. And to the extent that we're expecting our views to be listened to, we should listen to theirs. And to the extent that we're being critical of the arguments that we're hearing from them, we should be every bit as critical of our own arguments and our own assumptions, because that's how we learn. You know, what I do for a living, you know, I'm an educator, right? I'm a university professor. And it seems to me that this is a crucial step in the learning process, whatever tradition or viewpoint one may be coming from.
Well, you've engaged with some arguments or discussions with Christian scholars who don't agree with your approach to history. How would you characterize their approach to history, and how do they defend it?
I'm not 100% sure who you have in mind, but I'm not entirely sure that they really do defend it, at least not to my satisfaction. It seems to me that you'll encounter claims, you know, for instance, Tom Wright gives an example where in one of his books he actually said of a passage that's found only in Matthew's gospel, in which basically when Jesus dies, tombs are opened around Jerusalem and the dead start appearing to people. And it's very strange. I think even from the perspective of most Christians and most New Testament scholars, it's a really rather odd story. It's only in one source, so it seems clearly to have been added later to the story, the account of Jesus' crucifixion. And yet Wright's statement is, you know, it's such a bizarre story that, you know, maybe it's true. And another scholar who is also himself a Christian and a New Testament scholar, Dale Allison, basically in one of his recent books, you know, I think rightly says, basically just bogus. I don't think he puts it in precisely that terminology, but, you know, if someone were to if someone were to come to Tom Wright with a claim about a story in, let's say, the Islamic tradition or in some other tradition and say, well, this is such a surprising claim that maybe it's true, I don't think he'd be as inclined to accept it in the way that he is hoping his readers will accept it in the case of the story in Matthew. And so that's one example that comes to mind of somebody who I think is being credulous in the case of something that's in his own tradition, scripture, in a way that he probably would not be inclined to be if it were found anywhere else.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I think it was Tertullian quoted as saying, I believe because it's absurd or something like that.
Yeah, and I'm certainly willing to allow for some absurdity in the reality that we inhabit, but I certainly at the very least have problems with accepting the absurd in one's own tradition, but rejecting it as absurd in somebody else's.
Yeah. Well, you're giving a presentation at the Society of Biblical Literature annual meeting called The Blogging Revolution: New Technologies and Their Impact on How We Do Scholarship. Could you share with us what you think the impact of new technologies on the work of biblical scholars is?
There's technology which is perhaps no longer new, but is certainly allowing us to search texts, to find words across a huge database of texts, to access books and texts easily online. There's all of that technology which has been around for some years. The question of how blogging relates to scholarship is an interesting one. I certainly know that there was some disdain from older generations of scholars and older colleagues sometimes when it comes to the phenomenon of blogging. It's not entirely clear whether the blog as we now know it will be the enduring format or whether it will be replaced by something else. But it seems clear that one thing that we've often had to do in very convoluted and difficult ways, for instance, you know, I'm going to be reading this paper at an academic conference, right? Once a year we give everybody the chance to go together to the same place, listen to papers, and interact with one another there. And clearly this is a model that was developed before the internet and before it was possible to use Skype, and you could have a conversation with someone anywhere in the world and see them instantaneously without having to travel. And so it seems to me that sooner or later these technologies are going to take some of these unwieldy ways that scholars, not just in biblical studies, but in academic fields in general, have become accustomed to doing things, and suggest that perhaps some of them may be unnecessary, right? We can interact, we can share ideas, we can present papers and discuss them without having to travel. And so, to that extent, I mean, it's certainly going to save some universities and some scholars who have to pay for these things from their own pockets a little bit of money. But to the extent that that happens, presumably there are other things that could be done with university funds, departmental funds, personal funds that could support scholarship. And so there's a sense in which some of these technologies may free up time, effort, investment of funds for other things in scholarship. But it certainly seems to me that distance that once had to be bridged by travel in order to interact with your colleagues, that situation has changed radically. What we're doing now by having this discussion when, we're not in the same place, the fact that other people are going to listen to it, again, using the internet, it's changing the way we do things. And it's, in that sense, going to, I think, revolutionize the ways that we go about doing scholarship, but also the ways we approach scholarship, the ways we share scholarship. I think it's going to revolutionize education as increasingly we move not only to, let's say, electronic textbooks that you can read on an iPad or a tablet PC or a netbook. But I assume at some point we will stop simply presenting the print textbook on a screen and saying, here's an electronic version. But actually, once reading devices become the norm and every student has one, presumably we'll say, okay, well, this text can actually link directly to additional information. Things can pop up when you hover your mouse over it or tap on the screen if it's a mouseless device, as we seem to be moving to more and more. And so certainly when it comes to scholarship and education, I think that there are potentials for the technology that is now available that have not yet been fully explored but will be. And when it does, it certainly will change the way we do things.
Well, moving on to another topic, you've been critical and perhaps we might say dismissive of the Jesus myth theory. Could you tell us what is the Jesus myth theory and why do you think that it's so badly wrong?
Well, whether I can say what the Jesus myth theory is somewhat challenging, since every time I try to pin someone down, it seems like it says, well, that's not essential to it. Right? It's one of those things that sometimes seems somewhat amorphous. But it's the idea that the figure of Jesus is not simply a historical figure around whom myths developed and legends developed and additional information that is probably not historical came into existence around him and sometimes obscures him from view, but that he was a figure invented completely, sort of as it were, from whole cloth, as they used to say, invented essentially from scratch. From someone's imagination or a community's imagination. And the reason I think it's badly wrong has to do with method more than conclusion. Most of the proponents of this viewpoint seem to think that simply showing that it's possible that someone could have invented the figure of Jesus is all that you have to do to make a serious historical claim. And one comparison I've made that annoys to no end proponents of the Jesus myth viewpoint is that this seems to me to be exactly what Young Earth creationists and their ilk do, to say that, you know, God could have made the world, could have made living things in a way that just happens to resemble one that emerged through natural processes. The question that we ask when people make that sort of claim is, sure, it's possible in theory, right? You could have a God who wants to deceive humankind just so that we'll get ourselves into trouble. You can say anything. Anything is theoretically possible. What makes this likely? What makes it probable? Why should someone accept that view rather than one that treats the evidence in a much more straightforward way? Whether we're dealing with historical study or the natural sciences, we're usually looking for as simple and straightforward an explanation that can do justice to the vast majority, if not indeed all, of the evidence, and do so in a manner that's not merely possible, but probable. And to simply say, this could have happened, is not saying anything at all, right? Lots of things could have happened. And what I'm still waiting to encounter from representatives of this viewpoint is some kind of case that will show that this is not simply possible, but that in some way it does better justice to the evidence we have than alternatives. And in the absence of that, and in the absence of anything other than blogs and self-published books and occasional taking a stab at writing about Jesus from people who are scholars but not in the field of history of early Christianity or even that time and place, there's so much that's been written by people who have actual genuine expertise in the relevant time period, in the relevant source material, in the context and the world in which Christianity emerged, that to complain that historians are not taking the Jesus myth viewpoint seriously, again, sounds like the objection you hear from young Earth creationists. Why aren't scientists listening to these very important things that we have to say in our, you know, on our blog and in our, the things that we publish ourselves in our own, you know, publishing houses and things like that? Well, because there's enough stuff that's coming from people with genuine expertise that, you know, is reaching very different conclusions, that it's not clear why one would even, you know, entertain these things seriously. And so, I mean, I have no objection to someone making a case. You know, I would gladly entertain it. But the place to do that is in journals of history. Really, what distinguishes scholarship is not the conclusions. It's submitting your work to peer review, right? And submitting your claims to critical analysis by scholars. And to the extent that people who have the Jesus myth viewpoint are willing to do that, I'm certainly willing to engage in that kind of scholarly discussion. New ideas are what invigorate scholarship. If somebody had some kind of real genuine evidence that overturned much of our thinking about evolution, a lot of people would be surprised and shocked, but if there was genuine scientific evidence, that would be big news, and scientists themselves would be publishing it, right? Because science thrives when antiquated paradigms get overturned, when new evidence comes to light. Mm-hmm. And the problem I have with both young Earth creationism and with the Jesus myth kind of approach to the figure of Jesus is that you usually have to posit some conspiracy to keep the truth under wraps. And so in both cases, it shows a very mistaken understanding of how scholarship works. Certainly, there's resistance to new ideas because old ideas have become accepted precisely because there have been previous cases, you know, people spend a lot of time working through this evidence. But there's always openness to new information. And I know lots of scholars who, with whom I, you know, I have disagreements, I reach different conclusions, but they are trying to make a scholarly case for a scholarly conclusion. And they are working with the evidence, and they are engaging in a dialogue with other scholarship and are offering interpretations of things. If one is to do scholarship, and that's what I think those who are interested in history or in questions of origins of human life or those kinds of questions, one really needs to be engaging the evidence and subjecting one's own work to the critical scrutiny of other scholars. That's how scholarship works. And anyone who tries to bypass that, whether it's creationists or Jesus myth folks or anyone else, is really asking for a free pass for views that probably have not been submitted to publication in those kinds of venues precisely because they have not been argued and documented with that kind of level of detail and scholarly investigation.
So have the proponents of Jesus' myth theory been able to point you to any peer-reviewed literature in major historical journals that supports the Jesus' myth theory?
Not really. There's certainly one individual who has credentials in historical study, Richard Carrier, and he's written some things on the resurrection of Jesus and the empty tomb that I've found helpful. But he's also rather unusual among the Jesus myth folk for saying very ardently that there are some kinds of claims, about dying and rising gods and, parallels and things like that, that really are unlikely to be part of the explanation for the origins of Christianity, which seems to clearly be in a Jewish context. Another individual whose book is sitting on my shelf, and I hope to read it at some point, Thomas Thompson, right, who is a scholar who works on ancient Israel, has written a book called The Messiah Myth, which I think adopts a mythicist viewpoint. But again, he's a scholar of ancient Israel, right? So he's sort of dabbling in Jesus stuff. And from glancing at the book, I don't have the impression that he even spends that much time looking at Jesus, right? I think most of it is about David, and most of it is about the concept of Messiah in ancient Israel. And the one thing that I still have yet to hear somebody make a plausible case for is why someone would invent a crucified Messiah. I mean, what is the point of somebody actually inventing these stories and either passing them off as historical, as some of the Jesus myth folks claim, or telling stories that are easily mistaken for stories about a historical figure, when in fact they are, they're supposed to be about mythical things that happen in the celestial realm or something like that. But the short answer to your question is no. That kind of publication, I think, remains to be done, and if it's ever done, I'll certainly be happy to interact with it.
Well, let me ask you a pop culture question. You recently wrote about the new Sherlock Holmes movie, and you liked how it was kind of like Scooby-Doo, and I liked this about it as well, in that at first there appeared to be real magic going on, but in the end it turned out to be trickery and technology and ignorance and superstition. And in that and many other posts, you seem to be very eager to continue with the demythologizing project of modern scholarship. And yet, since you're a Christian, I suspect that you think that it turns out that maybe a few of the Christian miracles really are magic or something like that, and will not be revealed to be something else, as in Scooby-Doo. So why do you think that some Christian magic is real, and are there any reasons you could present to non-believers to think that some Christian magic is real, even though magic from other religions is supposedly just an illusion?
Well, that's a really good question. I suppose it depends what you mean by magic. I've certainly seen individuals who were not only religiously affiliated, but doing so in the service of making a point about religion, who are able to pull things out of hats or out of their sleeve. I assume that's not what you mean, though.
No.
I assume what you're really getting at is claims of, as it were, the miraculous, the supernatural. And I myself, I try not to be unnecessarily dismissive, because certainly our conclusions about things have changed from time to time, and try not to claim certainty where the appropriate stance is one of agnosticism. But it seems to me that, just as we said in the case of historical study, that it's inappropriate to say that the most likely conclusion is that your belief system is true, when the same arguments would not persuade you in the case of somebody else's.
Right.
It seems to me equally inappropriate to say that I don't see these things happening now, but if I find them in ancient texts in my own tradition, which are situated in the ancient world where such stories abound, the ones from my tradition are true. Right? The ones from somebody else's are not. I think that that is equally problematic. And certainly, I think it's possible, just as it's possible to rethink Christian theology in light of evolution and in light of scientific knowledge, I think it's not only possible but absolutely essential that we rethink much else in light of scientific understanding. And certainly one thing that I think is prevalent in our society, and really people who are thinking about their faith in a serious way don't think about enough, is that there's a tendency to thank God when somebody recovers from an illness, blame and maybe even sue the doctors if they don't recover, thank God if the tornado misses your house, if it demolishes your house, then, you know, it was weather patterns, or it was, you know. And there's this sort of bifurcation in the way we think about the forces of nature. But there isn't always a full-scale, consistent incorporation of scientific knowledge into our worldview. And certainly, ancient religious traditions, whether Judaism, Christianity, or anything else, had a tendency initially to personify forces of nature that were ill understood. And then as you get developments towards monotheism, you get a tendency to roll all the forces of nature into one. And there's a sense in which, you know, as our understanding has continued, there's a need for further revision along the same trajectory, right? We need to either find ways of thinking about the infinite, right, which usually is spoken of with symbolic language like God and religious traditions, in a way that either integrates nature into that, or otherwise, you know, make a much more distinct, or much a much clearer distinction between what we mean by God and what we mean by nature, which of course would take one in the direction of, you know, deism or something of that sort. But it seems to me that there's a place for what we might call, you know, a religious naturalism, and certainly the theological tradition that sometimes describes itself as panentheism, right? Or, and you also get this in process theology, really tries to take seriously, you know, nature as nature, right? The material world as what it is, and to reject some of these supernatural elements, not simply because of claims that they're unreasonable, but because they really are problematic in the context of our contemporary understanding. Now, that doesn't mean that some of the things that we've traditionally spoken about are not things that we'll continue to speak about in new ways. Just as we've traditionally spoken of the soul, and in particularly in the Greek and Indo-European traditions, you have the idea of the soul as a separate substance. Probably in light of our scientific understanding of human beings, we should think about this aspect of human existence as an emergent property of the brain and of, you know, material existence. We need to rethink some of our concepts in light of this, and I'm certainly happy to take what I guess you could call a Scooby-Doo approach to Christianity and not just to Sherlock Holmes.
Scooby-Doo Christianity, just it does, that phrase doesn't fit with the seriousness with which you're considering, you know, your own tradition.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot that we can learn from Scooby-Doo, I think. Certainly, you know, there's always some kind of explanation coming out at the end. And yet, you know, and yet Shaggy and Scooby are always terrified. You know, they just never seem to learn anything from all these past experiences. And there's probably a lesson in that, too. But I mean, if you can do Golden Rule atheism, then I can do Scooby-Doo Christianity.
Well, I announced on my blog that I would be interviewing you, and my readers said that I have to ask you about Lost. Why do you think Lost resonates with so many people, and what kind of interesting ideas do you see coming out of it?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm hoping to have some things that I've been writing about Lost and thinking about Lost appearing in various places in the not-too-distant future. What the theology of Lost is, what the outlook is hard to say. I mean, I think that we're going to be asking that question even after the finale, which we've now learned will run 2.5 hours. Even once that airs, I think we'll still be asking questions. I think the reason that it resonates with so many people is that it explores or brings into its mysterious narrative the language of God. It brings in religious symbolism, things that are very meaningful to people in our time. But it does so in ways that create mysteries, point to mysteries, lead us on to something else, right? You've got a church, but then beneath it is this Dharma station that's used to find this mysterious island. And so it's not giving us answers by way of those religious images. It's using them as ways of raising questions and exploring mysteries and telling a story that is very puzzling. And there's a sense in which I think that that is, in many respects, an appropriate approach to religion. And in fact, from the perspective of my own faith and my own outlook, that's, you know, where religion, I think, still has something useful to contribute. Not as trying to give definitive answers, especially when those answers are derived from texts that were composed before we had much of the scientific information we now have available, but as a way of exploring mysteries, right, of asking questions about meaning and value, asking about the ultimate. There's still a lot of mysteries, and it seems to me that religious symbolism is precisely what we find helpful as a way of not answering and solving those mysteries, as though the mystery goes away, problem solved, answer given, it's all clear, but as a way of exploring those mysterious aspects of life, those questions that puzzle us and are, you know, things that may one day, you know, may never one day be answered, but which still seem worth asking because they intersect with the big questions about life and its meaning and why we're here, as the traditional question puts it. And so Lost does a lot of that, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's popular. And I think there's an increasing, even as there's an increasing reluctance, you know, there's the rise of fundamentalism as a phenomenon in the modern era, and I don't think it's just going to vanish anytime soon, but there's certainly a willingness in other circles to recognize that there are some things that are genuinely uncertain, things that people once thought were certain are now uncertain. And the appropriate thing to do is to perhaps leave room for mystery and leave room for unanswered questions and to continue the exploration and continue digging and puzzling and discussing. And if there's something that people have been doing with Lost, it's puzzling and discussing.
You know, I'm struck when I'm speaking with non-fundamentalist Christians, particularly ones who are scholars like yourself and are aware of what the Bible is and aware of Christian history. There's just almost nothing that we even disagree on. And yet I'm using the word atheist to call myself an atheist, and you're using the word Christian. I'd be very curious to hear what it means for you to be a Christian, because if it means something like, you know, you admire a certain interpretation of the mission of Jesus or something, then I'm still, you know, very much of that bent as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. What you just said is almost exactly the same thing that came up in a public lecture that we had. You know Jennifer Hecht?
I don't think so, no.
You know, basically was an atheist, but of an outlook that, you know, left room for, you know, trying to find other ways of talking about those aspects of life that sometimes have been, you know, thought of in spiritual terms, you know, leaving room for the emotional, leaving room for awe and wonder and all those things. And her background is Jewish. She's an atheist. There was a respondent who's a rabbi in a local congregation and who said, you know, basically, I don't think we actually disagree about anything. I just think that, you know, this terminology of God is worth holding on to as a way of talking about and exploring some of these mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think very much, you know, for people outside of fundamentalism in whatever tradition, there's a sense in which that's the way the terminology is being used, and that's what we're exploring. And there's a sense in which, you know, there are some atheist authors with whom I would obviously find a lot more in common than others.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nice little book. His last name was Comte-Sponville, or Sponville, probably.
French,
it was translated. But it was the Atheist Little Handbook on Spirituality or something like that.
Right, right.
And he's had an experience, you know, that kind of unitive experience that mystics in various traditions have described. You know, is leaving room for the spiritual and mystery. And, you know, if there's any difference, it's only a question of, you know, what kind of terminology and what traditions and language we draw on to explore and ponder those kinds of experiences.
Sometimes I almost wonder if it sounds a bit like almost like a non-realism about religion, like Don Cupid or something, and yet somehow I imagine that you're not that radical.
I'm in two minds about Don Cupid. There's a lot that I like about what he says, but ultimately, I think the thing that might distinguish me from Don Cupid is that where I think he's certain that what he's talking about in terms of ultimate reality and some of these metaphors that we use, I'm not. I'm perhaps better described, you know, if you describe Don Cupid as a Christian atheist, perhaps. I'm probably much more of a Christian agnostic. There are a lot of things that I think, precisely because I study the history of these things, right, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot that is genuinely uncertain, and I think the appropriate thing to do when things are uncertain is to acknowledge that they're uncertain.
Yeah.
The thing I think would also be interesting to talk about further is the question of when, where, and how it's possible or useful for, you know, the atheists, agnostics, skeptical Christians, you know, Christian Buddhists, you know, the cats that people find it so hard to herd, whether in this tradition or that one.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether and to what extent it's appropriate, you know, to make common cause, you know, in arguing against, you know, let's say, young earth creationism and intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of controversy about, you know, should groups like the National Center for Science Education be saying anything about religion, or should they just say nothing and just say, you know, that stuff is bunk, and, you know, when it comes to matters of theology, just say nothing? Or is it actually helpful to fighting pseudoscience and fighting false claims and things like that to actually say, you know, it's possible to be a religious believer and to embrace good science? It's possible to be a religious believer and yet take the results of historical inquiry seriously. And so I guess, you know, it would be interesting to see, okay, you know, I find this God language and some of this religious language helpful. I'm guessing from, you know, whatever you mean by common sense atheism, you probably don't. But, you know, what do we have in common, and, you know, what can we actually collaborate on in spite of other differences we might have or different stances on things?
Yeah, I'm writing a book not to contribute to any scholarly debate, but just to kind of summarize my ideas on all of this. And my final chapter is about there's this podcast called The 52 Weeks, 52 Religions by an ex-Mormon who went around and visited 52 different leaders, religious leaders in his area from 52 different religions. And he said, you know, I go to the Unitarians and I ask, what should we be doing on this earth? And they say, well, you know, feed the poor and all this kind of thing. Help people, basically. And, you know, he goes to the Muslims, and that's what they say we're supposed to be doing. And he goes to the Baptists, and that's what they're supposed to be doing. And he goes to the humanists, the same answer. And so if the whole point of what we're doing here is the same answer from everybody, then it seems like we're spending way too much time bickering about the things that we disagree on and not nearly enough time getting together and doing the things that we all agree we should be doing.
One reason I find the label Christian helpful is that it was in the context of, you know, Christianity that I had this mystical experience that, you know, got me started down the path that led me to where I am now. And certainly in the past, there were times when I always said, you know, oh, you know, no, it wasn't psychological, it was spiritual, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Now I, you know, view it very differently and say, of course it was psychological. I mean, if it wasn't psychological, it wasn't an experience. You know, I mean, what could that possibly even mean to say it wasn't? And to ask the question of what it, you know, tells me about existence. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, I really am very much persuaded that Christians spend a lot of time trying to persuade not only non-Christians, but other Christians to adopt their stance on things about which the only honest answer is, we don't know. Right? I mean, even if you take for granted that some reality that can legitimately be called God exists, you know, you have creeds that say, you know, three persons, mm-hmm. one substance. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you know that? Mm-hmm. You know, how can we even, you know? And so if that language is helpful to you in thinking about reality and existence in some way, that's fine. But, you know, really, when we look at, you know, even we look at things like the teaching of Jesus, you know, there's so much emphasis on what you do. And one of the reasons why I criticized Ken Ham the way that I did is precisely because there's so much time being spent on things that, even if they're right, they're secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're right, but even if they were, I think that, you know, the money that was spent on a creation museum, I mean, I can think of so many better uses for that money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that keeps me thinking in religious terms is precisely that, you know, I have lots of values, you know, valuing other human beings, that, you know, it seems to me that no matter how much scientific discourse I engage in, I'm not going to be able to, you know, prove objectively to somebody who is a skeptic about it that other human beings are of intrinsic value.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to leave room for things other than scientific ways of talking about things. But so many of us agree on that it seems like we ought to be able to say, okay, yeah, you're a Muslim, you're an atheist, I'm a Christian, but, you know, there's some people over there who need help. And if we're wasting our time bickering about theology or whether God exists, then you're not a very good humanist, and I'm not a very good Christian, and you're not a very good Muslim.
You know, I'm calling myself an atheist, and you're calling yourself a Christian, and I'm still not clear what the actual difference is, except for the language game that we're choosing to play. Is there anything that you would want to challenge me on as an atheist? Something for me to think about, something for me to consider?
I mean, here's a metaphor that I find helpful in thinking about religion and religious belief and religious language and what its usefulness is. I try and imagine a conversation between two cells in a human body. And one of the cells says to the other, you know, I look around me and, you know, my life is meaningless. You know, we're born, we die. There's nothing but, you know, cells, other cells, we're born, we die, and that's it. And the other cell that he's talking to says, well, I sometimes wonder if we aren't, you know, part of one big cell, right? Maybe this all kind of hangs together in some way that we can't see from our level of things. And really, for me, religious language is saying that that second cell is onto something. You know, and when we talk about language such as language about God, really that's what we're saying. There are ways in which things hang together. There's, you know, a depth and an interconnectedness to life at levels that we can't, you know, we can't do anything other than perhaps intuit. It seems to me that that cell, not being anthropomorphic, is being cellulomorphic or whatever the appropriate term is. You know, the best that it can come up with is the idea that there's one big cell. And that seems to be what, you know, religious traditions that use language at all tend to say is, you know, God, you know, like a person, but only bigger, you know. And most theological traditions have acknowledged that that is at best metaphor and a lot of the time misleading. For me, religion is not about certainty. It's about acknowledging that there's depth and wonder and mystery and exploring metaphors that allow me to think about the world and view the world in a way that tries to do justice to that depth and richness and mystery. Yeah, and I think that's one of the biggest divides among religious believers in our time. You know, there are some for whom religion is the answer to all the big questions. And there are others of us, and I'm in the second category, for whom, you know, religion is a way of talking about mystery and using metaphors and symbols and symbolic language to talk about those things. There's a very useful discussion, even though there's some aspects of it that's problematic, but there's a theologian named Richard Grigg who talks about God as basically, and, you know, he's basically something of a pantheist, but basically says that, you know, God is useful language because, you know, when we talk about the whole universe, there's no way we can get a handle on it any more than, you know, if we talk about, you know, the whole population of America. I mean, it's too diverse, it's too vast. And so, you know, we use symbols. We use national symbols like the American flag or things like that to kind of give us a handle on something that is so diverse and so complex and so muddled in some cases that, you know, we really can't think about it without using metaphors and symbols. And, you know, whether you think the ultimate reality is the universe or a multiverse or something that transcends even that or, you know, is just infinity, it seems to me that, you know, this kind of language is useful if we're going to talk about such things at all. Since you asked for a challenge, I guess what I'd be interested to hear from you is, do you think about those aspects of existence? And if so, what kind of language do you find helpful in thinking about and talking about those aspects of existence?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are so many aspects of existence that are mysterious, and we often have to use metaphors to talk about things that we actually have great evidence and great understanding of. But the reason why I would not want to use religious language is because most people who are using the religious language are talking about it in these anthropomorphized or vividly supernatural ways. And that kind of discourse is just so disconnected from reality that I think it's doing great harm. And you probably agree with that to great extent. I mean, even if we're not talking about flying planes into buildings because you hear voices in your head, if we're talking about children growing up and feeling ashamed that they masturbate or something like that because it's an interpretation of an ancient text, or people making life decisions on the basis of a thought that popped into their head that they thought was God, rather than, you know, trying to look at the different alternatives and doing cost-benefit analysis and other better things that you might do to make a decision. I mean, just a huge array of things that are going wrong with the world because people are using religious discourse in the kind of pre-modern way or in the fundamentalist way. I just see that it's so distortive in almost all of its forms that when I see you using it and then I found out that you're not using that language in the pre-modern or the fundamentalist sense, I just wonder why. I think there's so much that's gone wrong because of this understanding of the religious language, that it's worth having to invent a new language. You know, that would be frustrating because we've got all these concepts already in play that we could just use, but the problem is that those concepts in play are so, you know, most of the time that they're used, they're so far disconnected from reality and in harmful ways that I just don't think it's worth trying to salvage that language.
And I respect that viewpoint. I sometimes feel the same way myself, but it seems to me that one thing that religious language does, you know, if one couples it with reason, because I mean, I think that the things that you describe, it certainly, you know, has, you know, religion as part of the picture, but I mean, the big issue is a failure to engage in reason thinking about whatever the issue is. You know, that's the fundamental issue. But on the one hand, less confident that we can start from scratch. I mean, certainly one thing that, you know, I've seen is that somebody will become an atheist, but oftentimes if their background was in Christian fundamentalism, they've gone from, you know, believing in a certain concept of God to not believing in a certain concept of God, but there's been no critical analysis of, you know, is there something fundamentally wrong with the outlook that, you know, they had? You know, sometimes that doesn't change as much as just one belief does. And it seems to me that religious concepts and language, to the extent that, you know, they can be reinterpreted, they can be coupled with reason. If I'm something of an evangelist for reason, this is one of the ways of building a bridge to people who might otherwise be resistant. You know, if you say, you know, okay, well, give up your beliefs that you already have, rather than rethink them in this way, you know, just abandon them all and start from scratch. Not only do I not think that that actually ever works in practice, but it seems to me that, you know, one thing I'm persuaded of, both from my own experience, but also as an educator, is that there are steps involved. You know, we rarely make any of our big changes in one sudden movement, right? It may be that there's one climactic, dramatic moment in it, but usually there's been some lengthy process that's been leading us there. And so it seems to me that certainly to the extent that it can be coupled with religion and can be interpreted in ways that, say, you know, when we have data from the sciences, we shouldn't take an ancient text and, you know, argue against the data from the sciences, you know, those basic things. Trying to even give as more biblical reasons why one shouldn't do that sometimes can be, you know, very helpful in getting people who are starting from a certain kind of religious viewpoint to move beyond it. In almost everything else, we go from, you know, sort of a childish understanding of these things to an adolescent rebellion against them to some kind of adult appreciation of, you know, there is no Santa. And there's no real magic, but there's something magical about Christmas time. And, you know, I can't find another kind of language that'll do justice to this. And it's only because there are people who are resisting and telling other people and persuading other people that you shouldn't take those steps, right? You should remain with the childish understanding of these things, that we have all these debates and we have all this controversy. You know, I mean, I'm hoping that religious language can be an ally in advocating reason. I may be wrong, but that's my hope.
Well, you know, I think you might actually have a point there. I was speaking with Jaco Gereke, who is a biblical scholar in South Africa working on the philosophy of religion of ancient Israel, trying to, you know, what are the metaethical assumptions of ancient Israel and all that kind of thing. And he was talking about his own loss of faith, and he was saying that, you know, in almost all cases, it's not going to matter if you present fundamentalists with arguments and reasons and evidence and that kind of thing, because the core issue, it seems to be, not that they don't accept the arguments, but that they don't know how to live any other way. It's just impossible to think of atheism. And I can understand that, because when I lost my faith in Christianity, when I thought that God didn't exist anymore, I thought that also entailed that there was no objective morality and or meaning or purpose to life. And so I didn't know how to live anymore. Now, I couldn't make myself believe anymore, but I just I had no idea how to even proceed with life. And I think that's the really significant barrier to us as Homo sapiens, is this thing that if you've been brought up that way, you just have no idea how to encounter the world or move through the world or do anything in a different way. And so if we use this religious framework that people are familiar with and already know how, they know how to live in that framework, they know how to live in that worldview, but just kind of slowly, you know, demythologize some of the well, probably start with the more dangerous parts of it, that might be a much more effective way than saying, hey, you've got to throw out everything that you think and everything that you know and everything that you use to live and start from scratch. That's a lot harder project to put on people.
And in one sense, I'd go further than you just did and say that it's actually impossible. If I don't know if you've ever had the chance to live in another culture or, you know, some other part of the world, but when you do, you suddenly find this whole society of people who basically take for granted modes of communication, you know, rules of politeness, all kinds of perspectives and ways of doing things that they treat them as natural, and they're completely unnatural to you because you thought that everything that you did in your culture was natural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think there's any way we can think ourselves entirely out of, you know, our, you know, cultural horizons, our human horizons. And so I think, you know, oftentimes if we think we're completely starting from scratch, you know, whether it's a person who becomes a Christian and says, you know, I'm no longer of the world, and like, yeah, but you know, your values look a lot like American Republican values. You know, what a coincidence, you know. Or whether it's a move in the opposite direction. You know, I mean, one reason why I, you know, try and work within this tradition that, you know, I've benefited from so much, but I'm not try not to be uncritical of,
uh-huh,
is precisely that if I were to change the label that I go by, my stance would not be 100% different. You know, it might be different in some important ways, you know, and that label might reflect some of those, but even if I were to call myself an atheist, would the things that I'm talking about using language of God now, would I cease to talk about them? Would I cease to think about them? Would I even manage to think about them in really, genuinely, radically different ways? I'm not sure.
Well, James, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you, too.